Hello, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Way podcast. I'm Alex, and I'd like to start with a bit of an apology. I on the pre few episodes ago when we were recording with Tampa against Forest, referred to Jean-Philippe Musetta as the dollar store, Isak. I'm here to hold my hands up and say I got it tremendously wrong. Isak isn't really even fit to polish Musetta's shoes. Musetta is simply the greatest to ever do it. He's going to score about 50 goals a season under Oliver Glasner. Simply the greatest of all time. And I'm here to sign every single dotted line on the apology form because Jean-Philippe Musetta is a man on fire. And on that bombshell, here to look at all things Palace from the last few games, looking at Newcastle, Fulham, and what the future holds for Crystal Palace is none other than Bobby Manzi, a regular on the pods, and of course, former senior editor here at the Palace Way. Bobby, how have you been?
Hi, Alex. I've not been bad. It's been a while since I've been on, but pleased to be back.
Likewise, pleased to have you. I mean, you've been in Rome, you've been at Arsenal and Chelsea press conferences at the men's and women's game, you've been doing all sorts. So, what have you been up to lately?
I've been thrown all over the place and trying to pick everything I can up, and it makes it hard writing about Palace sometimes, especially for the likes of Palace and Eagles Beat, because everything else is keeping me so busy. But just trying to keep on top of everything and trying to expand my footballing horizons as much as possible.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been really fascinating to see your rise, and obviously we're here for you. We root for you here at the Palace Way. So really glad to hear you've been busy, but I think it's probably a nice reprieve to be looking back at Palace because I think it's something you don't really get the time to do, right?
Yeah, no, obviously I go to most of the Palace games, if not all. So I obviously get to watch Palace a lot and get to talk about Palace a lot behind closed doors, but publicly not so much anymore. Whenever I talk about Palace, it's normally a story. So whether that's a transfer story or contract story or whatever, but in terms of actually talking about how well they've been playing, I've not really had that chance to do that because of my absence from the pod.
Yeah, but it's good to have you back and obviously really looking forward to get stuck in. Just a few headline statistics from Jean-Philippe Musetta. I mean, we spent the last episode looking all the way back at that brace against West Ham for the big man himself, obviously a resounding 5-2 win, but it's been such a while since the Newcastle game and probably even the Fulham game by the time this goes out that I don't think we're really going to spend too much time dwelling on the games at a granular level. I think fans are very familiar with what happened, they're familiar with the level of performances, but we will try and do them some justice before we look at kind of future-proofing and the squad and what's next for Palace in the long run. But just again, to go back to some headline statistics, you know, in April, and this is just in April, Jean-Philippe Musetta has 5 goals against 3.919, sorry, expected goals. I mean, he's obviously overperformed in that sense, but that's still a pretty good, you know, rate of chance creation there. In fact, 4 of those chances he created himself. He won 21 duels and had an average FOTMOB rating of 7.2. You know, he's been remarkably consistent, so much so that he was nominated for the Premier League Player of the Month. I don't think he'll get that. I think if I'm a betting man, I'd be putting money on Cole Palmer, who's also had a really terrific April with 2 hat-tricks in there. But nonetheless, I think this target man role under Oliver Glasner has seen Mateta hit new heights to his game. And it doesn't just feel like a purple patch. I think his overall tenacity, work rate, eye for goal has all gone up exponentially. And I think, you know, his work ethic is really well documented across media by a number of journalists who say he's kind of like the first in, last out in training. He's always asking the coaching staff, you know, what can I do to get better? He's putting in the work and it's paying dividends. And I think that's a testament not just to him, but to the staff as well for being able to pick out the next steps for Mateta and how he can really take his game to a new level. So just talk to me a bit about his overall game. I mean, you can reference the goals against Newcastle because again, he scored back-to-back braces between the West Ham and Newcastle games. And you can obviously talk about them too, but just his overall performance levels, you know, it's been phenomenal. So what have you made of it, Bobby?
I mean, we're talking about a striker, right, who 6 months ago struggled to play 60 minutes. He's now played 4 games in 13 days and put in a 7 out of 10 performance in 3 of those games. And all right, against Fulham, he was a little bit absent, but so were the entire team for a large proportion of that game because they just looked tired and they looked a bit drained from about half an hour onwards. But he's just been phenomenal. He's been a revelation. His finishing has improved so much. His general play has improved so much. He's winning headers, which he struggled to do before, which was baffling for someone at 6'4". He holds the ball up well. He links up well with the rest of the team. I can't say a bad word about the way he's been playing. He's just been excellent all over the pitch, defensively, going forwards. He's just been a complete player. It was against the Newcastle game where he ran half the length of the pitch to get back into midfield and dispossess Bruno Guimarães when they looked like they had a break on. He just works so hard. He applies himself so much, and he's just been phenomenal.
It's been a real, real pleasure to watch. And I think, you know, the way in which he interacts with the players around him, let alone create stuff by himself, is really, really impressive. I mean, that first Newcastle goal was something else, wasn't it? I mean, the vision for Mayu to kind of play this 1-2 with him and for him to burst through and just slot past the keeper was it's something we haven't really seen in his Palace career to date. You know, he's got 8 goals and 11 under Glasner. Point is, he's been in terrific form. I mean, he's equaled his tally from previous seasons in one season under the Austrian himself. So, I mean, it's just been fantastic to see, frankly. But, I mean, let's talk about Newcastle itself, because it's a game that I frankly wasn't expecting to win at all, let alone to have this kind of 4-game unbeaten streak. You know, they played really dominant football and we constrained them to 2 shots on target in the whole game. I mean, how impressed were you against Newcastle?
Yeah, I actually thought going over to Selhurst it was a Wednesday night. I thought Palace would get a result from the game. I was saying to the group I was going with, I thought Palace would get a positive result, not necessarily a win, but I just thought quite similar sides in the sense that they've lost a lot of players this season for injury, obviously, so they're slightly weaker. And they're two sides who I thought matched up well against each other. So I thought Palace, you were definitely going to see a good performance. But I didn't think you would see a performance as dominant as it was. As you say, limited Newcastle to 2 shots. I never felt really Newcastle threatened Palace at all. It was just total control from Palace and it was a really deserved result.
Dean Henderson is someone that's obviously been much debated on the podcast and on socials, but I mean, he had a fairly strong game, obviously keeping a clean sheet, but smothering Isak's occasional chances very well. I mean, how did you feel he was in that game?
I think he's been good under the Glasner the whole time, really. He's made one howler of a mistake. But other than that, I think he's been pretty strong. Palace have got 2 great goalkeepers in their ranks. And all of a sudden, things start to look really good at Selhurst, whether that's in goal, in defence, in midfield, up top. The squad looks to seem so much stronger. And if you look ahead to next season, they're going to build that depth even more. And things look promising in SC25.
I mean, that's a real key word there, promising. I mean, we just haven't had that in a long time as a fan base. And I use the word starved every episode now, but we've been starved of so many good performances and the sense of a real foundation being built. We obviously had Palace Tamper on for a couple of episodes and he did a really good job at detailing some of the statistical analysis on the underlying performances here. But you don't need data to look at the eye test and say, we haven't really had a stinker of a performance under Glasner. I'm not saying we play well every game, but in terms of the overall style of play and the overall work ethic of the squad, I think so much has transformed in such a short space of time. I mean, what do you think of Glasner and his ability to transform the squad? I mean, how successful do you think it's been? How do you see it going in the future? And what are the key differences that you're picking out as things that seem to really underline the change in philosophy?
It's interesting you asked that question, actually, because over at Arsenal yesterday, I was talking with another journalist about Palace and about the transformation under Glasner. And the one key thing that I pick up is the pressing football that Palace are now playing. It's, if you go and watch Palace now, you expect to see a good performance, whereas under the previous regime, you were going there hoping you'd hold on to a 1-0 or a 2-1, just that one goal win. But now you really feel that even if Palace are going to get beat, it will be in a positive manner. They will go for every game to try and win it. I pick out the Man City game, I pick out the Liverpool game. Palace played both of them games to win that game, whereas 6 months ago, they would have played to protect the 1-0 defeat. And it's just been so much better. It's been so refreshing to see Palace play, like I just said, the high-pressing football, the high-effort football. They try and create as many chances as possible and just have a real willingness to win every game they play.
Yeah, I mean, Newcastle really exemplified that in particular. Again, I think that's a game where on paper you'd be a bit intimidated by it, but with two teams in sort of very different veins of form, I think Palace really took it by the scruff of the neck and played with a kind of purpose and physicality that we wouldn't really have seen under Hodgson. And, you know, I think the domination of possession is a testament to that, let alone the ability to then smother chances and allow Newcastle to create very little. I mean, it was a footballing glow up is probably the best term, because that's exactly what it is. It's we've gone from this kind of very pragmatic, turgid Route 1 style of football or sort of playing for the counter-attack to suddenly, you know, playing with a real energy, playing with a zippiness in terms of moving the ball around from all ends of the pitch. There's a kind of structured build-up that we haven't really seen in a long time, and it starts at all ends of the pitch. But one pivot, I think, that's really, really impressed is this kind of makeshift Adam Wharton, Will Hughes kind of emergency duo. You know, we've obviously had a bit of a rough patch with Will Hughes being really in and out of the squad, struggling at all for anything with Vieira in terms of meaningful minutes, and particularly in that second season, and then to then come in and perform against first of all Liverpool and then to come in consistently like he has. I mean, it's just phenomenal. So let's focus on Will Hughes and then a bit on Adam Wharton later. I mean, how impressed have you been with the albino Iniesta himself?
Once again, I feel like I'm saying the same thing over and over again, because there's not much analysis to do. They've all just been excellent. I mean, Hughes, he's defensively, he's been phenomenal. He doesn't shy away from a tackle, as we all know, but it was the same under Hodgson. His work ethic is second to none. Going forwards, he's improved so much. He's got that out ball. He's allowed us to get forward a bit more. He's moved the ball out wide to Elise and Eze or Ayew when he's played there. He's just really been a dynamic central midfield player, and he's put the hard yards in, and he's given you a 7 out of 10 every single week. He's been really impressive.
No, totally. I mean, what's Glasner injected him with? Like, it's a real transformation for the man, and it's not just him, obviously, as you say. There is a collective transformation here, but you can pin it down at an individual level in terms of the beneficiaries from this. And, you know, he actually won man of the match versus Newcastle. I mean, his tackling, his ability to win the ball back was phenomenal. And bearing in mind all the headlines have been on Mateta, I think to actually burst through the scene and sort of attract attention like that is absolutely phenomenal. You know, even against Fulham, I mean, we've seen so many good performances there too. I mean, Chris Richards is someone I'll pick out, actually. He won 3/4 of his ground duels, 4 out of 5 aerials, 4 ball recoveries, all of his tackles, and got a 7.3 rating overall. You know, he's been everywhere. But, I mean, it's the same sort of physicality we see throughout the squad. You know, Adam Wharton is the highest rated under 20 player in the Premier League per sofa score. You know, there's so many good performances you could pick up on. And I think that's one thing that's really changed, you know, because when you look throughout the squad, I think there's a reputation that under Hodgson, we were a physical team, but I think the data doesn't show that, and the eye test doesn't really show that either. I think we were a bit second best.
Well, actually, I should have mentioned.
No, it's fine. Yeah,
Newcastle was a very. He did really well. He practically made the goal on himself. For it was Mateta's second, wasn't it? He's just been so good. He's been everywhere, and it's so much praise needs to be bestowed upon him, because as you say, the transformation that we've seen in the past 3 months, it's just been staggering.
You know, I'm going to hold my hands up and have a really weird confession. He came up in my dream like a couple nights ago, and it was really strange. I woke up not in my bed, but in my friend's flat. It was really weird. Next to my and I'm going to leave this in because I know it's really embarrassing to admit, but I feel like it's really funny to put in. I don't know what happened because there was so much talk about this contract. And I just kept asking him. I remember saying, like, is it done? Is it done? Is it done? Like, if you're going to sign a huge deal, like we signed Mbappe on a free or something. And he sort of said, yeah, it's done. Like, he barked at me. And then I'm pretty sure he told me to F off at some point as well. That's all I remember. It was really, really weird. There is a serious point here, though, in that...
some strange things in your spare time.
There is, yeah. What, look, my subconscious, all right, that's none of your business. Right? That's for me and the therapist to sort out, right?
I think we should move on to Adam Wharton quite quickly. Probably. Moving on, some might say.
No. I do want to... There is a serious point here in that, for whatever reason, there was a lot of talk about his contract situation. He was one of many players that were out of contract in the summer. We will do a big segment later on future-proofing and sort of looking at the new direction of the squad. But, I mean, we understand at the Palace Way, as to a number of sources now, that he hit a kind of appearance-related clause in his contract that meant his year's deal has been extended further. I'll say that again. But there is a serious point here in that we understand, as to a number of sources, that he had a clause in his contract which meant that if he reached a certain number of appearances, you know, his contract would be extended by a year, and it's clear that he's hit that now. So although it's not official from the club, he will be at the club next season. I think, if anything, there's probably a case to extend further, but that's, again, that's talk for another day, right? You know, that there is a depth conversation that we'll have later. And of course, his counterpart, Adam Wharton, who's been a mainstay since breaking into the squad. You know, he had a bit of a howler against Brighton, but that was a tough baptism by fire when he made his first sort of appearance in the Premier League. But beyond that, it's just been strength to strength for the youngster, so much so that he's getting England shouts. Just for some context, I mean, I've got the Fulham stats here, because again, I think we'll have to look at Fulham before we move on. But he got the assist, obviously, for the goal against for Schlupp. He won 2 fouls, got 3 chances created, 5 tackles, 10 recoveries, blah, blah, blah. You get the idea. It was commanding in all areas, whether it's actual chance creation, whether it's winning fouls, whether it's winning tackles. He's been an all-action midfielder that's likened a lot to Kobbie Mainoo at United, because both players have very similar profiles and age ranges. So, you know, I mean, do you think he could actually break into the England squad, particularly considering that, you know, the cap for the Euros has been raised to 26 in terms of the overall squad?
I think he deserves to be in there. Certainly off this showing since coming to Palace in January. I don't see why not. It just depends. It depends on numbers. I mean, the fact that there's 26 now is a boost to him. It just depends what direction Southgate wants to go in midfield. I think With the extra three players, the question is the focus going to be, I'm trying to be really careful with my words here, so apologies if it's coming out a bit funny.
No, of course.
With the extra three players, it depends if Southgate wants to go with an extra three attackers in the squad to provide some depth there. It's whether he's going to even it out between a defender, a midfielder and a striker. So it really depends on what route Southgate wants to go. But I don't see why he shouldn't be in there. I think Monday night will be very interesting to see how Kobbie Mainoo and Adam Wharton match up in midfield against one another. And I certainly think Southgate will be watching that game with a keen eye. I think the only problem that Adam Wharton has got is obviously he's only just stepped up to the under-21s. He's never been in a senior squad before. So putting a player straight into a major tournament squad does seem a slight risk if you look at it from Southgate's perspective. But I certainly think he'll be within the conversation.
No, definitely. I mean, it might just among the other 14 in terms of the non-Big Six Premier League teams. Tariq Mitchell has the best tackle success rate among Premier League fullbacks. You know, it's really, really staggering to see his rise as well. And I think, you know, there'll have to be a conversation about him too. I think with the injury crisis at left back, I think there's so many players throughout the Palace squad, frankly, that could be competing. You know, I'd earmark Gueye-Henese is quite likely to make the squad. So I think Mitchell and Henderson will be in that conversation. And I think Wharton as well. I mean, he's just been brilliant. And I think fans will already know how impressed we've been. You know, he makes the occasional mistake here. That's the one weakness of his game. But go on. Yeah.
Mitchell was unlucky to not be in the last squad. Southgate definitely considered him in the squad, but for whatever reason, that didn't transpire. Gerhi, I think, will definitely be in the squad, and I think he will probably be the third choice centre-back at the Euros. I think if he would have stayed fit, then maybe he would have been starting alongside John Stones, but, you know, he had the surgery and to ensure that he would be in the England squad, and I think he'll be going as third choice, which only does good things for Palace as well, because as we reported, he's expected to leave the club in the summer, and being third choice for England in the Euros means that his transfer value increases a little bit. And the other one, what was it, Dean Henderson, I think has got a great shout, obviously, with the Sam Johnson injury. I think Henderson's got a great shout to be involved in the squad. Who's he competing with? So obviously it'll be Pickford going. It'll be Ramsdale probably as number two. And then, yeah, you've got Henderson, Butland. Pope's not back, is he? Obviously Johnson's out. So yeah, I think Henderson's got a great shout. But I think you'll certainly see at least one Palace player in that Euro squad, if not three or four.
No, definitely. I think there's a lot of competitiveness right now, and I think injury really plays into our hands here. But, you know, this isn't an England-focused podcast. I think these are just nice accolades for some of our stars and the players that we grow to love over time. And, you know, I really hope as many of them can make it on the plane as possible to Germany.
I think it's quite relevant because every player that you get in the England squad, it ups your credit, if you like. It increases the value of your players. I think if you look at Adam Wharton, the sooner he gets in the England squad, the better for Palace, because I don't think he's going to be at Sellers Park for long. People won't want to hear it. But if you look how well he's done already, big clubs are going to be sniffing around him like they sniff around Eze, Elise, Gerhi, Anderson at a point. So every time these players make that step up, it does one of two things. It increases their value, but it also increases the appeal for younger players joining Crystal Palace Football Club. Palace love pulling players out of the Championship and bringing them up to Palace and them coming in and showing themselves off, if you like. And it's just every player that gets into the England squad, every player that gets that move away, every player that's got big clubs sniffing around them, it just increases the appeal to join Crystal Palace. So it only does good things for Palace.
No, it's definitely really true, because I distinctly remember Adam Wharton talking about this when he joined the club. You know, like he made reference to the fact that we have a proven track record of getting the best out of talent from the Championship. That invariably is going to have an impact on future recruitment. And before we get onto future recruitment, because I think that was going to be a nice segue, I do realise we should probably give Fulham a bit more attention. It was a shame not to make it 4-4, but Glasner's mentality has always been, you know, we want to keep the streak going. He's now said against, you know, the head of United that he wants to be unbeaten until the end of the season. I think that alone is a really good mentality shift, but we've kind of covered that. Let's just look at Fulham. Obviously a bit disappointing not to come away with a win, particularly after we played so well, this lightning kind of end-to-end start. Bit of a sloppy goal to concede, really. I think it was just a marking issue, but Palace eventually going on to sort of claim what I think was the bare minimum in terms of what they deserved from a Schlupp Wonder Strike. But let's just go back to the start. I mean, what did you expect going into Fulham? How did you think we played, and what were the key things you picked out, Bobby?
I wasn't really sure what to expect. That's a lie, actually. I thought Palace would go over there and win. But then when I got there, I started thinking, oh, actually, four games in 13 days, this could be quite difficult. And I don't know. The performance was good. Don't get me wrong, the performance was good. And there was a lot to admire about it. But for me, I think Palace were excellent for the first, like I said earlier, half an hour. And after that, the performance started to fall away a little bit. At the second half, I thought Fulham played some good stuff. I think Palace had the best chances in the game by far. I think Palace could have wrapped the game up by half time. But because they didn't take their chances, the fatigue then started to hit in after playing 13 games, 4 days in four games in 13 days. And the performance fell off a little bit. And then Schlupp scored the screamer, and I thought Palace were more likely to win it in the last 10 minutes. But yeah, it was a good performance. It wasn't as good as we'd seen in the previous three games. But nonetheless, it was impressive. And to keep the character after playing so many games in such a short period was good to see. And I think Palace did themselves proud.
No, definitely. I think it was a really encouraging performance. Like I say, I always go want to go back to this idea that, whether we win, lose, or draw, I think there's always been a good game under Glasner. I really don't think we've dropped anything less than a 6 out of 10, and that's being harsh, to be honest. I think even the sort of the poor results against City, or the sort of turgid draw against Forest, I think both of those games were very much fairly strong in relation to what we've seen for the earlier portion of the season under Hodgson. I just think he talks about a lot about this idea of intrinsic motivation. It's one of the core pillars of his philosophy, which is that, he trusts his players to self-motivate, to have that desire to constantly improve. And I think that philosophy of always raising the bar is something we never really saw under Hodgson. I think there was always a kind of a what do they call it with presidency? They call it like a lame duck. I was going to say dead rubber, but no, lame duck. I think with Hodgson being a lame duck kind of manager, there's always going to be this lack of a long-term project. And I think players intrinsically don't buy into anything because they're just there to kind of see out the season and just give it their best shot. And I think it's quite hard to rally around as a group from that sense. And I think Glasner's ultimate shift of mentality is just that. It's to give every player, whether it's Nathaniel Clyne playing out of position for the first time in his career like that, whether it's Will Hughes, who's not really had much game time in the squad coming in, harsh circumstances, whether it's an out of form Mateta finding new ways to take his game up to the next level, at all ends of the pitch, there's been this marked improvement in mentality. I also find it really interesting that with such a huge gap between Fulham and United, he gave the players 4 days off, which is pretty unheard of in most training camps these days. As a basically a reward for the hard work that the players have put in to go those 4 games unbeaten to secure Premier League safety and so on. And well deserved. Like, the players need that rest. They'll benefit from it. We know a number of players are returning on Monday night for the United game, not least Guerrier among them, which is a huge, huge, huge boost to the squad. It's really, really exciting to see him coming back. Although I have to admit, probably the last few games we'll see of him in a Palace shirt if and when he comes on. And speaking of that, I think I want to go to the main topic, which is something I teased at earlier. This idea of squad planning, because the noises coming out from Glasner in his press conferences were that we wouldn't really be making any big contractual decisions. We wouldn't be renewing contracts. We wouldn't be looking at targets in some detail until really the end of the season, or at least when we were assured of our status as a Premier League team. So I think now the real hard work begins in terms of actually laying the groundwork for the targets that we want. And more importantly, I think looking at who we keep and who we let go. So just talk me through who you're keeping, Bobby, who you think is going to stay. We know Will Hughes is definitely going to stay for at least one more season, but I'll get to the point here. Bobby, who in your opinion should Palace be keeping, and who in your opinion should be leaving?
Well, out of the out of contract players, obviously, Will Hughes's extension has been triggered for hitting the appearance related mechanism within his contract. And I think that was the important one to nail down because he provides really good midfield depth. He's been a revelation under Glasner. Oliver Glasner is said to be really happy with him. So I think that was important. Jeffrey Schlupp, I mean, you can keep him around the place if you want that added depth there as well. I don't think many people would be against that. Gyro, bless him. I think he deserves to go somewhere and play some football. I mean, he's been a phenomenal servant to the club. The fact that he's just been willing to sit around on the bench for so long and just be there just in case. And when he steps in, he always does well. He always gives you that 6 out of 10. But I think he should go. Then you look at the two right backs, Clyne and Ward. I think there's a case for both of them to stay, but there's also a case for both of them to go. there's also the case for one to stay and one to go. So that one really depends on what direction the club want to go and what direction Glasner want to go in, and I'm not entirely sure on that. Nathan Ferguson, I think he has to go. He's had horrid luck with injury, and he's never going to make it as a Premier League footballer now. And I think you can be as generous as you like and want to keep a player around, but it gets to the point of where you have to just cut your losses and end that. And if he wants to stay in some capacity, in like an ambassadorial role, I'm sure Palace would be happy for that. But if he wants to go and pursue a career in football, then obviously he's going to have to drop down quite a few divisions to get a chance. Tompkins, I think his time's up now. I think he's probably past it. I don't think he's even strong enough to be Premier League depth anymore. And Remy Matthews, I mean, he's a big character. Everyone loves him. He's the glue that no one really talks about. He in that dressing room, he's so important to keeping that whole squad together. And I think as a third, fourth choice on a not the largest salary in the world, I don't think it's any harm to keep him. But as well, it also depends on whatever he wants. If he wants to go and play in Scotland, if he wants to go and drop down a few divisions and be a first choice keeper, then I don't think Palace would be against that as well. And I think they'll let them go.
No, absolutely. I mean, it really sounds weird even talking about Remy Matthews because he's just not the most big figure in the squad, frankly. But, you know, what he does socially is quite important. And I think he's genuinely has such a strong connection with many of the players. I think he's someone that, you know, at very little cost is probably worth having around. But, you know, he was granted that leave to go and go on loan to St Johnstone because he specifically was promised game time. And, you know, from his perspective, I think it showed the right attitude to take that opportunity. So it could well happen. I have to agree with most of your assessment. I think my most controversial opinion is that, first of all, I did see a bit of controversy around Schlupp staying. I mean, I personally agree that I think he's one of the more valuable players out of contracts. And I think as depth, whether it's kind of in the attacking role we've seen against Fulham and so on, or whether it's kind of a left wing back cover for Tyrick Mitchell, I think there is a case that we would benefit from his depth so long as he's used in the right way and he's off the bench.
There's a mechanism in the Schlupp contract as well, isn't there? I'm not sure if it's appearance related or what. I'm not actually up to speed on that. But I know there's a mechanism in the contract that gives him the option to stay for an extra year.
Oh, right. Well, then in that case, it's kind of extra insurance. And I think that is something that's worth talking about. For what it's worth, I do think he will stay, actually. I know he's probably a bit of a high earner, but I think he would probably want to stay. I think he's probably willing to accept a lesser role. And I think he has shown his worth at times. I think he's really on the mend in terms of his recovery as an athlete, frankly. And I think he's a really, really good, presence to have with the squad as well. So I particularly think him and Hughes should definitely be staying. Actually, controversially, though, I was going to get onto this. I think both Ward and Klein are probably not past it because I think they've always got something to offer. But, you know, I think we do need to kind of cut our losses on a couple of these players. I simply don't think it's beneficial for us to try and afford to keep all of them. But that being said, I mean, I think in terms of, you know, players out, I think one thing I want to talk about is actually whether the likes of David Ozo and Hamada should get loans, because I think they're two players that I think have shown glimpses of real promise, but are simply going to benefit from this stage of their career with exposure at a new level, whether it's in the Championship, whether it's in a division in Europe, you know. And I'd like to get your opinion on particularly Hamada, because I think he's a bit more controversial. I think most people agree Ozo needs a loan. But what do you think about Hamada leaving on loan? Do you think that's something he would really need at this stage?
I think that Ozo needs a loan. I think that Hamada needs a loan. I think that Franca needs a loan, or Franca needs a loan even. I think Jez needs a loan. So I think there's four players there in that have been involved in the senior squad this season that desperately need loan moves. They're not up to speed for the Premier League yet. They're not ready. They've got good talents. They're good prospects, but they're not ready. Ahmed has come on and shown in glimpses, whether that's under Hodgson or Glasner. I think he's shown signs of promise, but he's never showed it consistently. He's never been given a chance to play regular football. And all four of those players need to get out and play regular football.
No, definitely. I mean, there's nothing to be gained from keeping them on the bench indefinitely when they're at such a delicate stage of their own development. So really, really interested to see what happens there. And I think if we're kind of underutilizing the loan market. That's generally how it feels. I think our loans have been not shoddy. I don't think they've been awful, but I think they've been a bit slapdash.
They have been awful.
Yeah?
Yeah,
go on then. Talk about that.
I don't want to talk too much about them, but we've had a couple of successful loans over the past 3-4-5 years. But you also have to look at the prospect, the quality of players you're dealing with. I'm not necessarily convinced that the quality of players we were loaning out or offering to be loaned out was quite there. And I think that's probably why clubs didn't want to take the risk on them, because they weren't convinced on their quality. I think you will probably start to see better loans now the academy is Cat 1, and now we start to see more players come through of a higher quality that have been at Category 1 their entire way through an academy. Because Palace have only been Category 1 for 3 years now, whatever it is. So you actually won't see the new players that have played Category 1 the whole way through their academy career for another 3 or 4 years. So yes, we can be harsh on the loan market. Yes, the loans have been a total failure, but also you have to take into account the context of, are the players actually good enough?
Yeah, I mean, invariably, I think there's only going to be a couple of prospects at the club that really have that Premier League potential. I think Jez is definitely among them, but I think at this stage, he's simply not going to be able to burst on the scene and be a wonder kid yet. I think he needs a Championship loan. Actually, interesting, we're recording on the day that Ipswich secured promotion to the Premier League. So, you know, just makes me think again about our chase for Kieran McKenna, and it somehow feels like we've got an even better manager, let alone the job that he's done there. So, yeah, really interested to see what happens with Jez in particular, because I think he's someone that could really
Franco
smash it at that level.
As well, actually. Now.
Yes.
Going out on loan. There's a couple of the academy lads that could do with going out on loan. Obviously, Mola will want another loan, you would suspect. Burton went okay for him. I wouldn't say it went great. I wouldn't say it went awful. It just went okay. He had quite a few injuries with his quite a few problems, should I say, with his hamstring while he was there. Trying to think, Kofi's obviously going to leave the club. Who else?
Well, I actually watched Kofi play for Wimbledon against Stockport in person. Went over to the.
He had a very good spell at Wimbledon. Very good.
It was good.
Every time I watched him, I was very impressed. Owen Goodman's going to need another loan.
Taylor, so many players.
Need another loan. There's loads of them that need to get out, and the club need to get this summer right, because last summer not getting Jez out was a total failing of the club. Yes, he ended up getting injured, and we can say in hindsight, oh, if he would have gone out on loan, he wouldn't have played anyway, but it's not the point. The point is he should have been out on loan, he should have been developing, he shouldn't have been wasting a season in the Premier League sitting on the bench.
It was definitely a consequence of poor planning. That was just what I was going to interject there with. It's an absolute consequence of that.
Said it, right? Gleeson said that the attacking quality Palace have got, there's no room for Jez on the bench at the minute. So that just shows you that he needs to get out on loan and learn his craft as a winger or wherever he's going to end up playing. Because at the minute, he's not good enough to play Premier League football because he hasn't developed enough. He needs to get out and play some senior football again. Cheltenham went well, but you can't go from League One to expecting to be a Premier League rotation player. It just does not work. He needs to go and play in the Championship.
Definitely. He needs to test himself at that level, because there's a risk in keeping him. You know, there is a risk in him actually not fulfilling that potential, and that, you know, the years tick by and he's suddenly not played at the level he should be with the number of minutes that he deserves. You know, he needs a full season where he's going to start most games. You know, it's simply that simple. That's a phrase. And speaking of, we need to move on, because one thing is anything but simple is the players that Palace should be targeting. We know there's a number of key links, and let's just take a look at some of those. Obviously, I think Palace fans will be aware that one player we've been heavily linked with is Ben Johnson of West Ham, who can play on either side as a fullback or as a centre-half. He's a free agent. There was a lot of links with Rangers, but I know the records over in Scotland were saying it was pretty much a done deal, but I understand that's not really the case. I know Edmund Brack of the South London Press says the same. Bobby, what do you think of that potential signing? And do you think that will actually happen?
I think it would be a good addition. He's very versatile. He can play fullback. He can play half centre-back, so the climb role. He's got a bit of pace. He's a decent defender. And he will provide good defensive depth for Palace. I think the club certainly like him. They tried to do it in January. I don't think that's a secret. But I don't think it's as close as the Daily Record made out. I'm certainly not aware of it being done. I know it's certainly one that Palace want to do. And if they can do it, they will. And they're certainly hopeful they can get it done in the summer. But it's nowhere near as close as some people have made out.
That's really interesting to hear, actually, because I was always sort of under the impression that, yeah, he's a big target, but not necessarily that it's close. I think there's a fair chance it does actually happen. You know, it could still be on, but I think that's just speculation. It's not nearly as concrete as you say. And we talked just then about Ozo and Ahamada going out on loan, and, you know, among a number of players, really. But we obviously want to make sure that there is that depth in place. And another free transfer we were linked with was Wilfred Ndidi of Leicester. Talk to me about that, whether it be a good signing, what you think the odds of that are.
It would be a great signing, but I can't see it happening. Palace, among every other club, like him. But yeah, he's going to have other options, and I don't see him ending up at Selhurst Park.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, obviously, I think the thing is with Ndidi, I think people look at him as though he's still 18, 19 Ndidi, you know, that kind of prime sort of mid-20s Ndidi at Leicester. But he did fall off spectacularly at the end of the relegation season for Leicester. And I know they've obviously bounced straight back up. But, you know, I don't think we'll necessarily hit that height. I think he's more of just an option. And I think you know, he'll be competing with the likes of Lerma and Hughes for places, but we have Decore and Wharton back as probably our first choice pivot. I say that Lerma could easily still keep his place. I think he's been phenomenal. There's all sorts of
back as well.
True.
So obviously you're going to lose Mark, so kind of opens up for the chance of Lerma left centre half, Anderson centre half, and Richards right centre back.
Yeah, true. I mean, Lerma's been phenomenal. I think his game against Liverpool exemplified that.
Money,
yeah.
Ultimately, it depends how much money Palace want to spend in the summer and where they want to spend it, which will be dictated to by sales. If they get 60, 70 million pounds from Mark Gerhey, do they want to go and sign some more depth in the squad? And are they happy to play Lerma centre half for the season? Or do they want to go and sign a couple of centre halves, build the depth there, and maybe sign a striker and get rid of Edouard? It all depends on how the sales pan out and then what way the ball want to go with it. Because there's quite a few ways that are being discussed at the moment. Nothing is set in stone. The plans aren't concrete yet. There's certainly players that I keep hearing that they're after, and there's a lot of stuff they want to do. Obviously, Lacroix, the centre half at Wolfsburg, they like a lot, but that's not going to be cheap. So it really depends on where the money comes in from, how many leave, and then how they want to spend that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is invariably the case for most transfer windows, but I think we'll have a kitty to play with based on sales. And speaking of, obviously, we talked about Mark Gerhey, Odson Edouard's been linked with leaving as well. I mean, who do you see being maybe the three? Let's kind of keep it more more niche. Who do you think are going to be the three key sales that we make in the summer, if you had to pick three?
Well, I'll pick two, and I'll say Mark Gerhey and Odson Edouard. I think they will probably keep hold of. And I'm not saying this as any knowledge at all, just to put a disclaimer on that. But I think if I use my understanding of how football transfers work, if you like, I don't see clubs taking the risk on Olise yet. I think you'll probably lose him the following season because obviously he had a lot of injuries this season. And I'm not necessarily sure clubs will want to take that on board yet. I think they'll want to see if he can be capable of playing a 38-game season. And I think Eze's more likely to go. Let me put it that way. I think there's a world in which they both stay. I think there's a world in which they both go. I think there's a world in which one goes and the other stays. It's very unclear at this point, and that's why I'm trying to put disclaimers on it and talk very vaguely about it, because it is unclear. And anything could happen. I think Palace fans should be prepared for anything to happen.
I mean, it's going to be a hectic summer, I'll say that. And I think it's a really good point you make there, because I think Eze in many ways is more mature and more versatile, probably slightly less injury prone, although I think that label's harsh for Elise. You know, he's someone I think who's still retained his value. And obviously we know that there is a release clause mechanism in both men's contracts. So really interested on that one. I think, you know, unfortunately, I have to agree. I think probably those are the three most likely departures. I think Anderson is close as well. I think he's someone who probably won't extend
his deal. I think
Anderson
will stay now, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to sell Gerhey and Anderson in the same window. And the problem you've got with Mark is that he doesn't want to sign the contract. He wants to leave. He wants to go and test himself at a higher level, which I think Palace fans shouldn't have a problem with, because he's done his service. He's been phenomenal in red and blue. And it's a part of the project. Ultimately, players are going to come here, use the club as a stepping stone, and go on to bigger things, because Crystal Palace aren't a Champions League club, and they're never going to be a Champions League club. They're going to probably get to Europe at some point, but they're never going to be a top four club. So, and they're never going to be competing for the league. And Mark thinks he's capable enough to go and play at that level. And I think he's right to think that. And he wants to be starting England centre-half, so he wants to move and he won't sign the contract. So Palace have to,
yeah.
And Palace have to sell him, because his contract is up, well, we're 2 years now, so it'll be a year by the start of the season. And you can't have a player going into the final year of his contract of the value of Mark Gerhey not sold or not signed on. So Palace have got no option but to sell Mark. So Mark will go in the summer, as I've already reported, he will go. And then Elise and Eze, look, there's a fee. There's a fee that the club will demand for both of them. There's a release clause as well, but it's quite complicated. And it depends if those fees or those clauses are met. And just currently, to give Palace fans a little bit of hope, I don't see those clauses being met just yet. I think it's more likely it's met for Eze, because he's in his prime and he makes sense for the one to go. But who knows? Anything can happen. And I'm not going to stick my neck on the line and say I think this, this and this, because ultimately no one knows. I don't think the club know which one's going to go yet. But I do think there's a certainty that Mark Gee won't be a Crystal Palace player by the start of next season.
Yeah, there's definitely a contingency plan in place for all of these scenarios. I think, you know, the club's been really thorough in that. I think there is a clear vision from a strategic standpoint that is there in terms of transfers now. I think
there's a list of 10, 15, 20 players for each position that Palace could sign. There's so many contingency plans in place, but you won't know which plan you've got to put in place until the sales have been made or until the approaches have been made. And as we stand on Saturday, the 4th of May at 3:23 p.m., no approaches have been made for Eberechi Eze or Michael Olise. No matter what anyone wants to make out that Manchester United are going to throw the bucket at these at Olise, no approach has been made. Are Man United going to throw the bucket at Olise? Who knows? Is it a story that people say that Manchester United are tracking Michael Olise? No, because every top club on the planet is tracking Michael Olise. So as it stands at now 3:24 on Saturday, the 4th of May, there have been no approaches for these players. And
I've just had a text, actually.
It's just something people have got to play the waiting game at. And it's as simple as that. The club have got plans in place. The club know what they will do if any of these players go. There's about 10 different players' names I've heard this week. And probably none of them will end up in red and blue. But it's good the fact that the plans are in place. And the club know what they will do should anyone come in for bids for these players.
Yeah, they're not sitting around plucking daisies at in the recruitment department. You know, they're doing their homework. There's a really extensive shortlist. I think one that probably leans quite heavily on talent in the Championship, but obviously not exclusively. And I think, you know, it's going to be a really exciting summer in terms of changes at the club, new faces coming in, personalities leaving. I think fans are quite well prepared now for a bit of goodbye for a few players.
Palace have been handed a big boost today, because it's no secret that they're interested in both Jacob Greaves and Jadon Philogene of Hull. And, you know, Hull failed to come up today. So that's a big boost that they're not going to be in the Premier League next season. They might be looking for the next step up, and Palace might be able to get a good deal for either one of those.
Yeah, Jacob Greaves really interests me. Left-sided centre-half at Hull, 6 foot, whatever, very commanding. You know, a huge leader in that dressing room and a big part of what went well for Liam Rosenia's side this season. Just narrowly missing out on the playoffs. But yeah, talk to me about that. Yeah,
Aston Villa don't have matching rights on... Sorry, let me start again. Aston Villa now don't have matching rights on Jadon Philogene because Hull aren't coming up. So that means Palace, if they place a bid in that meets their fee for Jadon Philogene, Philogene will be on his way to Crystal Palace. So Palace are now in a really strong position in the fact that there's two big targets there of Palace's, and I make no secret that they are two big targets of the club that have failed to secure playoffs and now will not be playing Premier League football next season. So Palace can now go there and say, look, we're offering this to the player. They can then talk to the players and say, Premier League football, and there's two signings already. All right, it's never as easy as that. But I'm just saying, things are falling well for Palace, that all of the players they're targeting are looking for clubs in the summer.
No, definitely. I think now that some of those question marks have been sort of removed and there's a bit more certainty now that we know how the Championship's ended, I think that will obviously affect some of the conversations about valuation. So it's really interesting to see. Thank you for your points there, Bobby. I want to end on one thing about the WSL, because I think, you know, we obviously spoke a bit about the women's team on a few episodes ago when you were last on. And I think, you know, now that we have the season completed there, obviously it ended in some style, securing promotion to the highest level of women's football. I mean, what a job Laura Kaminsky's done there. Can you talk to me about the season at large, just your reflections and, you know, what you expect going in for the next season?
Oh, it's been brilliant. The football Palace have played has just been sensational. They played the best football out of anyone in the league this season. And sometimes you see in any league of football where the team who play the best football don't necessarily win the league. But this, in the WSL, the right team won the league. Palace were excellent all season long. Annabelle Blanchard, I mean, was just phenomenal. The best player by country mile. They deserved it. The last game was a little bit anticlimactic in the sense that not much happened. But I don't want to take away from what was a phenomenal season. And every time I watched Palace Women, I was thoroughly impressed. They deserve to be playing WSL football next season. I mean, it's a remarkable achievement for a side that was struggling in the Women's Championship just a few years ago. Grace Williams and Laura Kaminsky have done a phenomenal job to transform the club. And look, they've got a massive task on their hands next year in the WSL. It's an extremely competitive league. You only have to look at what Bristol City done this year, coming up and going straight back down with, what was it, 11 points, 12 points. It was phenomenally tough for them. But Palace will give it a good go. They face a real test, trying to keep hold of some of their players this season, especially, as I've already mentioned, Annabelle Blanchard. I think a lot of big clubs will be after her. But look, all credit to them. It's a remarkable achievement. And playing WSL football next season, they'll be playing at a new stadium because Sutton isn't viable to be playing WSL football. You look at teams like Arsenal and Chelsea, who travel with 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 fans everywhere they go. So they'll be looking at new grounds. I understand that there's one ground in South London that they're quite close to agreeing, potentially playing there with. And things look on the up, and it's going to be very exciting next season in the WSL. And I'm looking forward to covering them.
Yeah, one little consolation, I suppose, that was a bit of a downer was Elise Hughes doing her ACL right before the season's closing. I mean, how important she been? She's been phenomenal, hasn't she?
Yeah, top goal scorer in the Women's Championship. She had a great season. Unfortunately, she's probably done her ACL at the worst time possible because she'll miss the entirety of pre-season. She'll miss the whole of the first half of next season and might not be looking at a return until January, which will then have a knock-on effect because obviously she won't be fit from missing pre-season. And you might not see her start to play 90 minutes until, you know, March, April next year. So she's going to be a big miss for Palace, and they're definitely going to have to sign a striker in the summer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a really young group. It's a real rejuvenated squad with the new management as well. I think, you know, to have that turbulence and to then come away with a title-winning squad is just something else. I mean, it's a real testament to the work that's been done there, both on the pitch and off it. And obviously, we'll be paying a close attention to everything that they're doing next season. I mean, for a club like Palace to pride itself on its progressive South London roots, to not have a team at the highest level of women's football feels a bit of a shame. So I think to actually have made that achievement happen is something that I think we can all be really proud of as a brand, but more importantly, as a community of fans, a community of people of South London. Really, really good, like, phenomenal achievement. And obviously all the best from everyone at the Palace Way to Laura Kaminski's side. Yeah, thank you very much for your analysis, Bobby. I'm going to end on one very small question, just relating to the men's team and squad planning for the next year. We obviously spoke a little bit about player of the season, and I'd like to know who your player of the season was. Obviously, we didn't get to have you on the last few episodes, but I want to get your thoughts on that because it's a big debate at the moment.
I hope he's going to save that for my season review article, but as you are so nicely, I will tell you. For me, probably it's a choice of two players. It would have been between Jean-Philippe Mateta and Jefferson Lerma. And purely off consistency over the whole season, I can only give it to one man, and that is Jefferson Lerma. I mean, what a signing. Free from Bournemouth in the summer, he was their player of the season for 2-3 consecutive seasons. I don't know, I can't remember. I just remember it being a lot. So to go and take another Premier League club's player of the season, and for him to slot in as well as he did, he's never dropped below a 7 out of 10, whether that's at centre-back or in midfield. What a signing. Player of the season, by a country mile for me. Obviously, Mateta is an honourable mention. I think Mitchell had quite a strong season as well. He very rarely drops below a 6 out of 10. Just trying to think who else has done well this year. I thought Johnson had a good season, but been unlucky with injury. I think Elise, when he's played, has been unplayable, but he's just not played enough. And yeah, I don't really think there's anyone else that stands out for me. But yeah, definitely Jefferson Lerma. Player of the season, just what a signing is all I've got to say, really. Just so good defensively, so good attackingly, so good going forwards, even, I should say. And yeah, I think the prospect that he couldn't be starting for Palace next season is kind of scary considering how good he's been. So that's something Palace needs to get right as well, making sure they find somewhere in the starting 11 for him, because obviously Decore is going to be coming back. Adam Wharton been phenomenal since coming in January, and I think if he would have had a full season, he would have had a massive case for player of the season as well. But things look really good.
Yeah, there's so much optimism in a way that we haven't had in a long time, and I think, you know, Glasner is at the centre of all that by successfully implementing a much more progressive style of play, as we've been discussing, you know, to round back to the start of the pod. But, you know, from a squad planning perspective as well, I think it's going to be a really, really exciting summer. So thank you very much, Bobby, for all your thoughts. Of course, you can follow all things Palace at thepaliceway.com, and you can follow our socials on, particularly on X, at thepaliceway, all one word. If you haven't done so, please leave us a review. You can give us 1 star, 5 star. We prefer 5, but you can give us whatever you'd like. We just really want to improve, as we always say, and everything that you send our way, we really take on board. We really appreciate your feedback. We've had loads of great feedback, particularly on the last few episodes. We hit successive records now in terms of downloads and unique listeners. So things have really been on the up, and it's only a testament to you guys, the listeners, that we can make this happen. So, you know, this is just one string to a wider bow. We want to deliver you a strong package as a fan across, you know, our website, our socials, the podcast, and so on. And it's your feedback every step of the way that makes it happen. So thank you again for all your support. We'll be back after United to review all things Palace again. If there's ever been a time to play United, it's probably now. You know, it'd be amazing to do the double over them, because I think that's probably a once in a, probably a lifetime opportunity in this stint in the Premier League. But
you want a prediction from me?
Yeah, go on.
3-0 Palace.
3-0 Palace.
Yep. Mateta 2, Elise 1.
Oh, I'd love that. I would love his third brace for Mateta.
They're without Fernandes as well, aren't they? Man United?
Yeah. I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, I know he's been playing injured, and now they're saying that he's a doubt for the game. And that's a huge miss for them. I mean, he's probably been their best player this season. They're not playing very good football. They're a poor side by all accounts. And Palace are probably one of the most form sides in the league at the moment. So I struggle to see a world in which Palace don't beat them. Like I say, I'm as confident
That's
enough.
Really
to
bold.
Confident enough to see Palace win 3-0. I say this as a total neutral as well. Confident enough to say that I think Palace will win 3-0. I was talking to journalists over at Arsenal yesterday. They were all quite of a similar saying that they think Palace will beat Man United quite convincingly. So no doubt the Palace way is to probably lose that game 1-0.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm probably going to go
for I genuinely do think Palace will beat Man United quite comfortably.
Yeah, be really, really interesting to see. Obviously, we'll have, like I say, all things on that game and plenty, plenty more in the next episode. But all that's left to say is a big thank you from me, and we'll see you in the next one. Up the Palace.